From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The term Ebonics was coined in the early 1970s as a way of describing language patterns used by some African Americans. By the 90s, a school system in Oakland, California passed a resolution adopting Ebonics as a native language. Not long after that, a national controversy erupted. One senator at the time, Locke Faircloth of North Carolina, called the acceptance of Ebonics one of the most absurd examples of political correctness he'd ever seen. A couple of decades later, the debate is still alive. The terminology, however, has shifted to African-American vernacular English. Sociolinguists say the language patterns that make up this kind of English are not only as structured as so-called standard English, they're also complex and quite legitimate. That's the crux of what we're going to explore today, along with the implications for people who do speak African-American vernacular English, or AAVE. Joining us in studio today to talk about his work teaching young African-American men how to move within white middle-class American culture, Frankie Roberts. He is the executive director of LINC, or Leading Into New Communities. Frankie Roberts, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Also with us today, he's a sociolinguist at North Carolina State University and a pioneer in the field of African-American vernacular English. Walt Wolfram is the author of more than a dozen books on dialect, including The Development of African-American English, Dialects in Schools and Communities, and American English, Dialects and Variation. He's also the director of the North Carolina Language and Life Project. Walt Wolfram, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. If you'd like to share an experience you've had with linguistic profiling, or tell us what you think about the acceptance or rejection of African-American vernacular English in the culture, send us an email. That address is coastline@whqr.org. We'll also open the phone lines in a few minutes as well, and you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. Walt Wolfram, as a sociolinguist, would you say there is a correct way to use the English language?
There is a socially designated way to use the English language. It's not correct linguistically. It's a matter of social pressure and social norms. But linguistically, African-American English or Appalachian English is the equal of any standardized English. It's simply a matter of who has the linguistic power, who has the social power, and language follows social power.
And why do you say, as a linguist, from a linguistic perspective, it's as legitimate?
Well, because when we look at it, we look at the various rules that govern. So a person may look at a particular structure used by an African-American, such as the use of be, as in sometimes my ears be itching, and they may say, oh, that's incorrect English. But from our perspective, we look at as a form of a grammar and how it's used and find out, for example, that that form is used to indicate habitual action. So a person might say, my ears usually be itching, but my ears, but they would not say my ears be itching right now. So we look at the structure of the language and follow the patterns that are used by speakers, which is a wonderful testimony to the human mind and its capability with language.
Frankie Roberts, you spend a good part of your time teaching young African Americans, boys and men, how to navigate what you call white middle class culture. And to a lot of our listeners and a lot of white people in the community, the fact that that even needs to be taught is sort of mind bending. Tell us why and tell us what you teach.
Well, it's necessary, as Brother Wolf has said, that because who has the social power? And in this society, white middle class and upper class primarily have that power. So in order for a black person, since I cannot hide the color of my skin, there are things that you try to leverage that creates equality. And speaking the King's English well is one of the things that help us navigate white male culture or middle class culture. And so we teach young men how to, you know, we would use the word code switch, but we teach them different approaches that will help them in their process of becoming successful in the society. And English and the King's English is one of those things. So as I normally say, I wouldn't say Brother Wolf been gone, because that's what we would say if somebody asked us, where's Brother Wolf? I would say, Brother Wolf been gone. Mm-hmm. Versus in the King's English, we would ask a young man to restate that in the King's English, and we would say, Brother Wolf left 18 minutes ago.
It's interesting to me that you even, because you've done two things here, Frankie Roberts. You've used the term code switching, which to me implies that we're just switching back and forth between language forms. There's no judgment on one form over another. They're just different. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying black people have to switch back and forth.
Right.
Because typically I'm going to go back to my neighborhood that does not necessarily, well, I won't be able to communicate as effectively as I would otherwise. Because if I told some of my white friends, let that window up, they're going to say, you mean roll it up, lift it up? And
right.
They say, do I need to give the window permission to go up? And you say, let that window up. They wouldn't know what I was talking about.
Right.
So we have to go back and forth because we don't typically have the power to do anything other than go back and forth.
The power. And you also refer to the other form of English as the King's English, which also is there are implications of power in that term. Well, Wolfram, would you normally call what white middle class people speak the King's English, standard English? How do you refer to this?
Well, titles and names are always problematic because you can't use them without sort of understanding the political power. So I have spent, 4 to 5 decades talking about terms. I would simply refer to it as what people refer to as mainstream English if they want to use the term standard English. I understand that. I understand the hierarchy. My argument is that people learn to use standard English not because the system that they have is inferior, but because it provides the cosmetic that goes along with functioning in that social setting. So I tell students, it's not that something's wrong with your language. Your language is great. Let me tell you how it works, and it's really cool. But by the same token, if you're going to an interview and you're expected to wear a suit and you show up in jeans, that's problematic. So in that sense, there's nothing inherently wrong with the language. It's wonderfully patterned. It's wonderfully systematic. But there are expectations in terms of situations. And if you don't act according to people's expectations, whether they're right or wrong, and they are often wrong, then you are judged accordingly.
Well, Wolfram, in an interview with our producer, you talked about diversity and how, a new diversity officer was recently hired at UNCW. This is a new role. And you had an interesting observation about race and other parts of the culture, and you said something about language getting left outside the door of the diversity office. What did you mean by that?
What I mean is that we celebrate all of these different strands of diversity, whether it's race, ethnicity, religion, sexual preference, gender, and so forth. But we never talk about linguistic diversity and how important that is, and how to embrace people who come from different backgrounds linguistically. And so one of the things that we're trying to do, for example, at different institutions, including North Carolina State University, is when new faculty, when new students come to student orientation, they are told about linguistic diversity at our institution and how it's a part of celebrating who we are and who we represent and all of these different regions and cultures and different social and ethnic groups. So our point is that we need to start including language in education an acceptance of diversity.
And Frankie Roberts, when you're teaching your students about navigating what we're calling white middle class culture, is there any judgment going on? Do you teach correct and incorrect, or are you teaching this is one form and this is another form? How do you approach that so your students don't feel belittled?
Yeah, they're equal. We that's why we ask them to restate it, because we believe that knowledge without zeal would get you killed. So if I go back to my community, not that it's dangerous or anything, but you know, it's always good that I can still engage and communicate effectively if I might have a corporate job that requires me to speak and know when I say the King's English, which I'm glad Brother Wolf made a good point. We almost use the word King's English as being condescending, for the lack of a better word, because it's to make fun of, like, you know, that it is above when it shouldn't be. And it is definitely equal. I was a barber for a living, so I became, you know, I used to speak, you know, I'm around guys that I'm familiar with. We speak how we speak. But when my son, my youngest son, went to Eaton Elementary here local, which is predominantly white, he reacquainted me with the King's English.
They always teach mom and dad something, don't they?
Yes. So I went from dad to father.
Really?
Because he started saying, yes, father, because that's the guys he hung out with all day. That's how they primarily, or yes, dad versus uh-huh, dad.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about the role of African-American vernacular English in our schools and our culture at large. Walt Wolfram, sociolinguist at NC State, is here along with Frankie Roberts from LINK. If you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 910-343-1138. Email is coastline@whqr.org. We'll be back in a moment. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio today is Frankie Roberts, Executive Director of LINK, Leading into New Communities, and Walt Wolfram, a sociolinguist from NC State and Director of the North Carolina Language and Life Project. We're talking about the English language and African-American vernacular English, the changing view of this dialect, and the impact it can have on communities and individuals. Do you think AAVE has a role in mainstream American culture? Is the rejection of this dialect analogous to racism? Tell us what you think by calling 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastlinehqr. We have a clip from a documentary called Do You Speak American? And I want to get the reaction from both of you to this clip. It demonstrates how many American California schools actually use knowledge and structure of African-American vernacular English in the classroom as a tool for teaching children how to speak using the standard American English dialect. So let's listen to this.
Here we go. My grandpa cooked dinner every night.
Her person singular. Cook. My grandpa cooks dinner every night.
Which linguistic feature is not in mainstream American English?
Third person singular.
Yes. And Marisol, how do you code switch this into mainstream American English?
My grandpa cooks dinner every night.
You just got 500 more points. He's funny.
He is funny.
Okay, Ariel Barón,
what's the answer?
He is funny. He is funny? Excellent translation. Here we go. We don't have nothing to do. Okay, quiet please.
We don't have nothing to do.
Oh, I'm sorry. That is not, I'll wait, that is not accurate translation in mainstream American English.
Okay, that last bit, nothing. It was so heart-meltingly adorable, this little kid. But Frankie Roberts, we found this clip notable because the teacher is using the terms code switching and translation. In other words, again, we're talking about two different languages here, not one being correct and the other incorrect. Do you think that's an acceptable way to teach young kids how to speak standard English?
Only if I'm going to provide a reward for being able to code switch versus being able to speak one over the other.
What do you mean by that?
In that particular clip, they were rewarded for speaking the standard English. We wouldn't reward a person for speaking standard English. We would reward a person who could effectively go in between the preferences.
That's an interesting observation. Yeah.
That way it's equal, and that's why we tell a person to restate it, because it's almost like speaking English versus speaking Spanish.
Walt Wolfram, what's your reaction to that clip?
Oh, I love the clip. I was a part of the advisory board who was behind Do You Speak American? And it's a wonderful incentive. They were playing the game Jeopardy using code switching as a part of that. And that's a wonderful incentive. Actually, what people may not know is we have a curriculum that is endorsed by the Department of Public Instruction for teaching Voices of North Carolina to eighth graders in North Carolina. So any teacher can spend a week teaching about the dialects of North Carolina, which includes everything from coastal English, Ocracoke and Harkers Island, to mountain speech, Appalachian English, to Lumbee English, to African American English, to Spanish, and even Cherokee. So there is a program where kids in the schools in North Carolina in eighth grade, as they study the history of North Carolina, can learn about the rich heritage of its language as a part of that history as well.
And that is that the North Carolina Language and Life Project, or is that a separate
thing? That's a curriculum under the rubric of the North Carolina Language and Life Project.
Tell us about that project. What is that project?
So that project is trying to raise awareness about language differences as an aspect of culture and background and diversity. So in that context, for example, mountain speech is seen as sort of a product of the migration, the Scots-Irish influence and so forth. And African-American English, like any other language variety, would be viewed as a language with a history, how it came about through the Caribbean, from West Africa, through the Middle Passage, and how it left its influence on African-American lives. So it's just a part of the cultural and historical and linguistic background like any other aspect. And that's what we're trying to get kids to learn and appreciate, and they love it.
It sounds like it would be fascinating in a classroom setting and really help to sort of anchor those lessons about history. And I want to have you talk more about the origin of it in a moment. We have a couple of calls and we have an email, and I want to get to all of these. They're raising interesting issues. You're listening to Coastline. If you're just joining us, we're talking about African-American English, frequently called Ebonics. What role does it play in our culture, in our schools? Is it part of a rich cultural heritage, or does it label a person and potentially close doors to jobs, housing? Here to answer your questions, a sociolinguist from NC State, Walt Wolfram, and executive director of LINC, Leading into New Communities, Frankie Roberts. If you'd like to ask a question or share an experience, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Steve from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. There is a big difference, it seems to me, between appreciation of linguistic diversity and the practical work that Frankie Roberts is doing with the young man that he teaches. And it's even more different when you look at it from the perspective of a public school teacher, which is what I was. I taught ninth grade English, and about 30% of my students were African American. The norms of the curriculum for ninth grade English are based on standard American English. And so there's this tension from the perspective of both teaching and grading of appreciation of linguistic diversity and fully understanding that it is its own African American vernacular English is its own variety of language with as rich as standard American English, sometimes even richer. The tension between that awareness and the practical needs of instruction in a different kind of English, and the tension arises over making clear that the teaching is designed to enhance what the kind of thing that Frankie's doing, which is to say, look, here's the way the world really is, and there are consequences to you if you are not able to code switch. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, I have an actual question about that. I'm getting there. But it seems to me that the concept of the need to code switch is a pretty advanced concept. It requires to some degree an understanding of how our culture works in terms of race. So I guess what my question is for the professor is, how early does this instruction start, and what rationale — some teachers don't think you have to provide students with the rationale for learning, but I do — what is the rationale for doing so, and how early can you do it?
That's a really good question, Steve.
It's a really good question, because the fact of the matter is preschool kids have language attitudes, and preschool kids show language prejudice. So you can never start early enough.
What do you mean preschool kids show language prejudice?
Okay.
How?
So I'll show you. I'll tell you as an experiment. Okay, so you have two voices in a box. They're not seen. And they're imploring a three-year-old to take a set of crayons and a coloring book from them. And one voice sounds black and one voice sounds white. And the kids are asked, take my coloring book. And so the kids are then asked to choose, which coloring book do you want from which kid and why? And what you hear is kids saying, oh, that voice sounds mean. Three-year-old, right? Talking about an African-American voice that has been identified. So that's what I'm saying.
Three-year-old white kids or three-year-old?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. Actually, the experiment was done with primarily white kids.
White kids.
All right. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if that would be similar, but at least it indicates a kind of linguistic profiling. So I would say it's never too early to include diversity. And I understand and appreciate the caller's tension that he sees. But there's an important point in which Frankie's program and our program complement each other. A kid who feels good about the way they talk because it has a history, it has a structure, it has a system, is much more likely to take the risk and learn standard English than one who feels, oh, I just don't talk right to begin with. So, and actually, we also have results on that show that kids who learn about language awareness, about differences and diversity in dialects, are actually do better in standardized tests when they actually come to that point.
That's interesting. Steve, thanks so much for your call. We need to move on. Joe from Curie Beach, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. The court systems and the police and other agencies provide translators for foreign language speakers. I was wondering if there's any effort for helping people that speak AAVA exclusively.
In other words, translators within the judicial system, or are you talking about within, say, the police force?
Both.
Have either of you, Frankie Roberts, have you heard of anything like any kind of initiative like this?
Yeah, actually, the federal government do have those type of translators that translate Black English, Ebonics, have you, and especially with the rise of the hip-hop culture and some of the words that is almost meant to be kind of coded. So they have hired individuals and pay them a lot of money as a in fact, to be able to go through certain paragraphs, sentences, cell phone conversations to interpret it, for the lack of a better word. And I know that the federal government have that around, not just black folks, but other cartels, for the lack of a better word, that they find.
Yeah, but no local, state or local here in North Carolina that you know of?
Not here in North Carolina, but we are, in fact, our Light Manhood program, which is our youth program for African-American males, we are conversating with the police department to teach, and I shouldn't say teach, but have a professional development class that teaches the hidden rules of the so-called inner city. And certainly language, body language, and historical thought processes or practices is a part of that. And so we are proposing to do that here locally.
Thank you.
Language, thank you, Joe.
Language
becomes a very important tool in understanding intent. You know, so for example, I remember back in the 70s, there was a Black Panther trial, and the Black Panthers, one of the members was saying, "Off the pigs," referring to kill the pigs. And the question of, is that a literal threat on the life of a police officer, or is that simply a way of speaking that is highly agitated? So I would say that issues of this type are very relevant to our society, how we interpret crimes. As a matter of fact, there's a whole field of linguistics called forensic linguistics, in which linguists come into play doing everything from sort of, well, copyright issues and interpreting message and so forth. So these are or for example, you take the case of Rachel Chantel, whose language in the Martin case was highly suspect and became a critical component. And juries were saying, "I didn't believe her because of the way she talked. I couldn't even understand her." Yes. So the language becomes a critical component of that.
Frankie Roberts, do you think that if more law enforcement officials and police officers who are actually out there on the front lines were conversant in African-American English, that it would lessen the tension between communities and law enforcement?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
If you could give a quick lesson right now to some members of law enforcement, what would you say, number one? What's one of the biggest sources of misunderstanding there?
Well, when we talked off mic, is one of them is making fun of the language. So if I come into a neighborhood and say, "What's up, brother?" and that's not who I am, the person see that as being inauthentic and pretentious, and you're making fun of me versus just being who you are, then that comes across better. And accepting how I speak as an equal, I think that's the biggest tension that you find, is that one is better, one is greater. And if I took the time to get to know your language or culture, then I feel like that you are not disregarding me, but accepting me and embracing me.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about African-American English. What role does it play in our culture, in our schools? Here to answer your questions, a sociolinguist from NC State, Walt Wolfram, and executive director of LINC, Leading into New Communities, Frankie Roberts. If you'd like to ask a question or share an experience, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Addison, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. This is my first time calling the NPR.
Well, welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
Well, my question is, I was someone who was raised through a Catholic school, kind of taught, I guess, the King's English, with a very strict sense of what is the right subject verb, what is the right noun, what is the right, I guess, sentence structure. However, in addition, my family, my mother and father, are from the coal mining region of Pennsylvania, near St. Clair. So I get a lot of interesting dialect from there. Then I went to Appalachian State and was introduced to the Appalachian dialect. And I was just wondering, just the question would be, as, I guess, this field progresses, in our schools, will the English language be, I guess, taught more, grammar will be taught with more leniency, more forgiving of, I guess, different ways to speak it? Or do you kind of imagine a future where there's a, still a very strict right way to write, speak, and spell?
Walt Wolfram, are we losing the prescriptivists? Are we becoming more inclusive in the way we think about language structure?
Well, I think we're becoming more flexible and tolerable. Even if you look, for example, at newscasters today versus 30 years ago, they're much more relaxed. By the same token, prescriptive norms are a part of life. And we'll always be here. People want to tell us how to dress. They want to tell us whether to wear socks or not. They want to tell us how to do our hair. So if we think there's going to be a day when we're beyond prescriptivist norms, Lord bless you, because it ain't going to happen. And as a matter of fact, and linguists, although they like to rail against the non-prescriptivists, have their own little prescriptive niches. So, for example, we want to make sure that we use ungendered pronouns so that we use they instead of it. So everybody has a bit of prescriptivism in them. And I think we have to understand that that's a fact of society, how it operates, and it's not going to go away. But we are more relaxed. And as students learn more about language diversity, I think they are more relaxed about it too.
Addison, thanks so much for your call. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about AAVE, sometimes called Ebonics, African American Vernacular English, and why some people speak it, why some people reject it, and some call it a highly complex and legitimate form of the English language. With us to answer your questions, Walt Wolfram, a sociolinguist from NC State, and Frankie Roberts from LINK. You can ask a question or make a comment by calling 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. We'll take a short break and be back in a moment with a listener email. You're listening to Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Frankie Roberts of LINK, or Leading Into New Communities, a local nonprofit that teaches young African Americans to navigate middle-class white culture, and Walt Wolfram, a sociolinguist from NC State who's authored a number of books on dialects in the English language, including The Development of African American English. If you'd like to ask a question of our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. We have an email from George in Wilmington, and he is asking, what is the difference between dialect and patois, for example, Jamaica?
Well, it's a matter of degree. I mean, something like the typically called the patois or Creole language is simply more mixed with elements of other languages and dialect. But a more interesting question, in a sense, takes up the issue of sort of the politicalization of language, and that is, what's the difference between a dialect and a language? And what we find out that it can't be defined structurally in terms of language, so that it turns out to be a political issue. And as someone has said, the difference is a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. and for that reason, for example, Swedish and Norwegian are quite mutually intelligible, but yet they're considered languages because they have a state boundary between them. Whereas Chinese, there are a number of Chinese languages which are distinct and not mutually intelligible, but are called dialects because it unites a people. So it really becomes a more political issue. And while we're talking about African American English, on that basis, some of my colleagues, mostly African-American colleagues, prefer the term African-American language because it legitimizes it among languages. Dialects tend to be inferior to languages. So the issue between patois and dialect and language are all highly political issues. Not the answer that people wanted. They wanted a simple linguistic explanation. But there is no such thing.
Frankie Roberts, is there a resistance in the African-American community to teaching AAVE or AAE or Ebonics to white people? Would there be a loss that happened there? Is there, because Walt Wolfram was just talking about how a language unifies a people. Is it okay to let people from other communities in, or is that, did this develop for other reasons?
Oh, man, that's complicated. I think the politics of it is a challenge. I think within our community, you probably would have some disagreement, some agreement. However, I think as Brother Walt just brought out, because, you know, I was having to be the student just now. So when you have that type of information, I think the more information you have, the more informed your response is. So if that kind of information was dispersed throughout both communities, it probably would kind of lower the bar of tension, for the lack of a better word. So I'm without information like that, certainly your goal is to be equal. And then when language is used as a filter to be prejudiced or to discriminate, that's where the imbalance come with blacks. So if my language is equal, even if I taught African-American language or dialect, then we would be fine as long as it's equal. But if teaching Ebonics, for the lack of a better word, would put me politically inferior, then I'm going to have an issue with blacks who would teach it. And so that's and one of the things I'd like to add is in our community, when we speak the King's English or standard English well, then whites typically say he's well spoken or he is so intelligent only because of how I speak the King's English or standard English. And to me, that's offensive because that's not something whites say to each other, that they're well-spoken or they're intelligent based on how well they speak. So those are things, again, that kind of creates these artificial barriers that separate us because, you know, you just said to me, black people don't typically speak well.
You know, Frankie Roberts, that is such an interesting point. And I've actually heard this before, and I've heard African Americans say, you know, don't say I'm articulate. Yes. Come on, I mean, what do you expect? But I'm not convinced that white people don't say that to each other, because I think that I've heard white people say that to each other. And I understand why it could be read as an offensive remark, but Walt Wolfram, as a white guy, is that something? Is that a remark that you would hear one white person say to another?
Typically, whites don't say that to each other unless there's some exceptional reason. So, if a Southerner, which is considered less status than a Northerner, would say that, they say, "Oh, you know, John Edwards speaks very articulately for a Southerner." And so there's actually a whole book on this by a couple of linguists about Barack Obama and the description of his speech, even by his vice president colleague. You know, for a black man, he speaks really articulate. And as Frankie just said, that assumes that we don't expect black people to talk that way. But I also want to bring up another issue that was raised, and that is whites sometimes in high school, because blacks are considered cool, will sometimes cross and speak like them. And we have a whole term for it, and it's been studied. It's called crossing. But what's interesting is that if you follow those kids as they grow up and out of high school, they don't talk like that anymore. Because the difference is that whites have an option. I don't have to talk that way anymore. And if I want a job out there, I'm going to have to talk white mainstream. And so they can do it during a period of adolescence when they're trying to be cool and hip. and then go back to being white.
So that sounds like a form of cultural appropriation.
Yes, it is.
Like,
yeah,
I'll
exactly.
take this piece,
yes.
uh-huh. and I can use it for a while, and then I can take
cool.
it off.
While I'm trying to be cool as a high school kid, but when I'm out there in the world and need a job, I don't need that anymore.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about African-American vernacular English, frequently called Ebonics. What role does it play in our culture and in our schools? Here to answer your questions, Executive Director of LINC, a local nonprofit leading into new communities. That's Frankie Roberts. And a sociolinguist from NC State, Walt Wolfram. And Walt Wolfram is going to ask you about the origins, because you've written an entire book about this,
right.
the origins of African-American English. And you were saying earlier that this is a language that doesn't really have, you were comparing it to, say, Swedish
yeah.
and possibly French. These are associated with geographic places, but there's no geographic place associated with AAE. Can you talk about how this grew up?
Yeah, well, there was a contact situation. So actually, the language of West Africa because of the trade and then the slave trade, so it followed the route toward and left an indelible imprint on it. So as people who spoke different African languages, whether it was Mandinga or Ewe or whatever it was, would learn English. Be forced into camps where they spoke a specialized kind of English, and the imprint of that language contact situation has actually affected it. In a sense, it's no different from the fact that mountain people have the imprint of Scottish English on them. And so it happens to be that there's a link between the Caribbean, there's a link between West Africa, there's a link between Gullah in South Carolina, and then there's also a link to African American. The important point here is, like any other language situation, it comes from a background. The background is different. Obviously, when you have slaves and you have owners, it's a very different one. But there is a very distinct and well-formed linguistic heritage that we can sort of follow in terms of the roots and the migration of African Americans in the United States.
And all language changes over time, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
There
yeah.
are rules, the grammatical rules that we would consider broken today that were perfectly acceptable
Teenager speech, I mean, they'll kill their parents, you know, by adopting a language change where they use like to introduce a quote or a thought quote. So he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, what do you think I'm doing? And parents, these kids use like all the time. It's driving me crazy. You know, hey, language change. If language change is going to drive you crazy, then get used to being crazy. Because it's happening all the time.
If you'd like to ask a question, we have about 7 minutes left in the show. Give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. We're talking about African-American English and the role it plays in our culture and how it's viewed. Frankie Roberts, there is an entire sector of African-Americans, men, women, younger, older, who rail against the use of Ebonics or African American English, and they say it's something that is putting obstacles in your path for no good reason, just because you're attached to your culture, and we have to not speak that way. What do you say to those folks who consider this a perpetuation of some sort of cultural divide?
Well, it's correct. The studies show that if you speak Ebonics and to the degree where a person recognizes it, it's going to cause a 12% less earning income of blacks. That's what the studies show. So there is an outcome, and the outcome in a lot of cases will cause you not to be able to be employable. Sometimes it's going to affect where you live. It affects a lot of things. So I think that as we can push more, as much equality that's tied to English or language, then we try to kind of walk that fine line. So, yes, we would have an issue with that.
And you talk about code switching in terms of the men and the boys that you work with. You say, you know, this is one language, this is another, and
Correct.
We're going back and forth. And you don't criticize them for the use of that. But Fox News, for instance, recently did a story about an African-American teacher who is crusading against the use of that language at all. And there, you know, he talks about the difference between ask and axe and really teaches the kids that there is something inferior about that language. How do you feel when you hear that? What would we lose? What would this culture lose? What would the African-American culture lose if we lost African-American English?
I think we would lose a lot, and heritage is the biggest thing we would lose. And at the end of the day, whether I say ask or ask, you know, at the end of the day, does that make me a bad person? Because speaking it the way I was taught, and I think we take, in cases like that, we create those illusions or those artificial barriers because I'm looking for a reason to not like you, to not accept you, to not be equal to you. And so I think it's, again, just a artificial barrier. But I think culture is rich, heritage is rich, and with that becomes language.
You're listening to Coastline. And Gordon from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I had a question. I was trained as a radio announcer and a narrator, just like Rachel, and we were taught to speak in, I'm talking back in the 60s and 70s, standard American English, which is supposedly the way things are written in the dictionary and pronunciations, but now after, you know, years and years of time going by and being a little bit older, I realize that that's presuming that people know how a certain sound is supposed to sound, and of course, you know, if you pronounce a certain sound like an upside down E in the dictionary one way, it's going to sound differently to someone else. So how does that relate to this?
It's a good question, Gordon. Walt Wolfram.
Well, the fact of the matter is it's impossible to speak English without speaking some dialect of English. Even broadcasters have to choose whether they say, for example, the vowel in caught. Either you choose to say it as caught, you know, however you say it, you have to make a dialect choice.
And you're talking about the past tense of catching a ball.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Because actually many dialects don't differentiate between the thing that you lie on and the thing that you catch. But the reality is that in this whole scheme, certain kinds of variations are more acceptable than others. So axe, for example, is sort of this icon of stigma, despite the fact that in the history of the English language, the axe, ask, actually resulted from a transfer. The original verb was axion, which actually, so it was originally pronounced as axe, not ask. And it was the change in the English language that gave it the ask pronunciation. So there are all these sort of curiosities of history which show how arbitrary language is. It's not about language. It's who you are in your representing language. So if the change is middle class, it's acceptable. If it's not middle class, it's not acceptable.
And that is an excellent final thought. Thank you so much. That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Walt Wolfram of NC State, Frankie Roberts of Link. Thanks also to you, our listeners, and those of you who emailed in your comments. Join us for the next Coastline when we take a ride on the rivers of North Carolina with explorer and anthropologist Monroe Fisher. That's next Wednesday at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline is produced by Isabel Shepherd. Our technical director is Ken Campbell, and Alexa Doran is our webmaster. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.